and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Dalton of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz, never letting the critics and naysayers get in the way of my dreams. That's why we're here every Thursday from 5 to 6.
That's right.
Rain or shine, heat warnings and otherwise, you will not ruin my dreams.
Great. That was the key lesson from this week. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcasts from Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today we talk to... Well, actually, we don't talk to... Well, we'll talk
we're
to...
We're just going to talk to each other.
Yeah, well, we usually do. But we're going to talk about the upside down. That was a convenient metaphor I used when talking about the nearly invisible struggles of Guelph's poor and struggling in a Guelph Today column. And it seemed to hit a nerve with readers, so we're going to talk about why those issues go sight unseen and why the column got the reaction it did. And then we will welcome Steve Dick and Anne Gajerski-Colley of Democracy Guelph to the studio and get an update on their efforts to keep electoral reform front and center and their promotion of local proportional representation as an alternative voting system. But first, there's been a lot of talk about cultural appropriations this week, and it's more or less being phrased as a bad thing. And then this guy named Hal Nijewski wrote an article for the Writers Union of Canada's magazine that basically said that we should be encouraging cultural appropriation instead of encouraging writers I'm not sure this was made explicit, but we shouldn't just encourage people from those cultures that have been run roughshod by Whitey, but that it's okay to, you know, take from those cultures and reach out and use your imagination and put yourself in those cultures. And then he went so far as to propose a cultural appropriation prize.
And that's when his foot went into his mouth and was shoved in further by Twitter. Yeah. Twitter seemed to be the undoing of all of these people that have chimed in so far.
If that wasn't bad enough, he didn't mean it in a satirical way or framed it like that. He was quite serious. And if you read the article, if you read the editorial, first of all, it was also in the cultural. It was also in an issue of the magazine that was dedicated to Aboriginal writers. And so to start off that special edition, he starts off by saying, you know what, cultural appropriation isn't always bad and we should encourage writers to do it. I think the core thesis of what he was getting at was, I think, correct, which is that, you know, writers should be putting themselves in the mind of not just people like themselves, but of other people too. We should be, you know, exploring different cultures should be, you know, researching and being more inclusive of different cultures. That you're here, the hero of your story shouldn't just be, you know, middle class white person. Why can't it be someone who is, you know, of African ancestry, of Native ancestry, of Indian ancestry, Asian ancestry. You know, I think that makes sense to me as a writer myself. But then he took it too far with, like, let's have a prize, let's celebrate who can rip off who, which seemed to take it like a step too far. And then on top of it all, as you said, there was the Twitter thing where I think it was Ken White, who used to be with Rogers, said that I'm going to put in $500 to this prize. Who's with me? And then you get a bunch of people like Blatchford and
Jonathan Kay,
thank you.
Although I don't know if he actually mentioned putting in money.
I don't think he put money in, but he was
lost his job. Oh, no, sorry. I didn't read. There was an article about his why I resigned from the Walrus. There was a bit of an implication that he was going to go anyway. That there was some sort of difference of opinion there. But that's what he says.
But there's also a lot of backstory there about his tenure at the Walrus and a lot of it about how he's, you know, basically screwing freelancers, stealing ideas, stealing prose. So, you know, his tenure at The Walrus was hardly sparkling up until this point.
But he's also, knowing him from his other capacity as a commentator and what I call the hipster panel, I don't really know, like the Sunday, the Sunday panel on CBC that has, let's say, younger people who all are also like... Not millennials, probably Gen Xers for sure. I still call the hipster panel because it's all, like, hey, man, let's talk about this. And he is probably the person that would put this kind of thing forth on that panel. And I'm not, I was never really sure whether he was trying to be the contrarian, because usually the panel is generally, the other panelists are people of color.
Yeah.
Just how it works, this setup. I don't want to talk too much about the CBC panel, but that's the only, that's, I know of Jonathan Kay from that.
Mm-hmm.
And he is always the guy kind of on the other side of the table saying, well, you know, so to hear that he may have sided with us. And this is the problem, is that I don't think Hal Nedvecky really used his words properly as a writer.
No.
I mean, think about it. He's writing for a magazine that only writers read, and an issue that he had asked, if I believe it, if he's the editor, he would have sort of guided this edition, which was supposed to be about Native our indigenous writers.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have worded it very differently. Once again, I didn't rehear him commenting on something I didn't read, obviously. But, you know, it's one of those ones where you know how it's going to go down, where it's sort of like you make this comment. I don't know if it's he's trying to be incendiary or what, but then it goes down the spiral. And then this, the appropriation prize. I don't know if you saw anything of Jesse Wente. I watched him or part of that interview that he had, and he was very, I mean, he was deeply saddened by this, because I mean his comment was, well, if you don't know, folks, Jesse Wente, if anybody listens to CBC Radio in this town has heard Jesse Wente, because he's on all the time, indigenous writer and commentator, and I mean his comment is the short of it was that cultural appropriation is institutionalized.
Yeah,
and it doesn't take much. I think somebody put the montage together with the pictures of everybody who had chimed in on this, and it's white, white, white.
Mm-hmm.
Blatchford, I understand. There's names you hear on that. You'd be like, yes, they would side with that. I don't know where Levant stands on it, but it's the kind of thing that he would probably dedicate much rubble, whatever. He can't really call it ink, in my opinion, too. So,
pixels.
Yeah, pixels. Dedicate pixels. Bandwidth. Dedicate bandwidth to this. This is the kind of thing that they seem to love there. Missing the point completely, right? So in that this is where it, who made the comment about something, you know, we have it's the maple leaf versus the Inukshuk.
Yeah.
These are two sort of things that are kind of not appropriated in some way as symbols of the country. I know it's something to do with Canada 150. So, I mean, you see the Inukshuk everywhere in context that's nothing to do with its origins in Northern Canada. And I'm pretty sure you can buy them at the airport. Which is another long-running tradition, right? But yeah, it's I'm not surprised that how hard this hit and came down that quickly.
Right. Well, like I said, the first part of it made sense in that you know something like, I don't know, you know, there's a new Star Trek show coming up, and the lead is African American. And a lot of people online, because there was a trailer for it posted the other day, and you go to YouTube, and a lot of the comments are like these disgusting comments about,
you can't be that color.
Yeah, about how you can't have a black woman as the lead of a Star Trek show, because that's the point.
The show that was like completely cutting edge on racial issues in that
exactly.
Back in the
60s. But you know, there's that kind of disgusting stuff. But the people behind that series, of course, are white. You know, the guy who created the show is white. The guy who's the executive producer of it is white. The guy who directed it is probably white. I think through that lens, that was kind of the original point that Nedvecky was trying to get to. It's like, you can imagine yourself, your hero can be a black woman, even though you are a white male writer. But then it's couched at the end with this, you know, sort of, you know, sharp tongue attempt at being like subversive and being edgy by saying, let's have a prize for who can cultural appropriate the best. Because when I hadn't read the article when I started digging into this, and I was able to find the article, And it's one of those cases where the headlines and the aftermath make it sound much more incendiary than it was. Mm-hmm. But I think what really took it down was, yeah, the Twitter factor. And you had all these people who are from the mainstream magazines, again, all white, all mm-hmm. middle class, saying, oh, yeah, no, this totally makes sense. Let's have this prize. And you have people from McLean supporting it, the National Post supporting it. And it becomes a free speech thing.
Pile on, too.
Right. But it becomes a free speech thing. And I don't think the point was free speech. The original purpose of the article wasn't even free speech. The point is that these people don't understand. And you listen to the Aboriginal point of view, and it's that they're entire existence since the first white people landed here mm-hmm. has been cultural appropriation. We appropriated their land. We appropriated their history. Because if you go back to those like heritage moments that the government produced, and there was the one where Cartier arrives and meets the Aboriginal elder and they don't understand the language, and the priest is like, oh, no, he means this is a great nation called Canada. And the other guy's like, no, I think he means the village. And it's like, oh, that's a cute moment because Canada means village. And then you're thinking about, like, what are the odds there was this like sort of meet cute moment between, you know, the French explorers and the local indigenous people. It's like that might have been a nice moment there, but that's hardly indicative of the history between white people and Aboriginal people.
And then the priests came. Anyway,
yeah,
exactly, and that, yeah, and I guess that's a whole separate world unto itself. The Canadian moments, because they're making new ones now, and I think they're getting better. I mean, mm-hmm. you remember those? It's like Hinterland Who's Who, another Canadian moment thing that from the past that seems really cheesy now, but they were trying their best to make some kind of point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's. Well, it isn't really difficult. If it's taken that way, then that's the interpretation given to what Ned Vetsky said, right? It's, but I think this also leads into the business we were talking before about Desmond Cole and where the lines are, what you can do, and you can be a so-called activist with a newspaper. I'm thinking particular in the Toronto Star, which has always had a bit of an activist-y edge, Michelle Landsberg, people like that, who wrote mm-hmm. for years, Joe Fiorito, who wrote a fantastic city column about problems in Toronto in the projects, let's call them, for lack of a better word. I know that's probably not the best term, but, you know, certain areas of town, Regent's Park, which is now gone, St. Jamestown, and he was on that all the time. To me, that qualifies as activism. And then you have somebody like Desmond Cole, who didn't even disrupt a meeting. The meeting was over. Still contributing to the narrative, I guess. Once the meeting was over, he's like, no, I'm not leaving. Mm-hmm. And he gets taken down by the Star. He's like, no, you can't do that. So yeah. I know that's not specifically cultural appropriation, but I think it's in the same family of this, where it's like the established newspapers and the media, CBC, and I mean, you name it, what's left of the newspapers, have this sort of old model that's never really been dragging the future. I know CBC tries really hard, right? They try hard for diversity in that. They try mm-hmm. super hard. Mm-hmm. But yet there's still this, I mean, I'm sure if you pull back the curtain at the meeting, you know, the same with Gomeshi as well, that there's an ingrained kind of standard there. And if something like this cultural appropriation award was supposed to be kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink among the writers, sure as hell didn't work. Mm-hmm. But because that's the vibe that I got from it, was like he was trying to make some kind of point. It's like, well, you know, it sort of sounds like it should be sarcastic. But then when everybody starts piling on and throwing money at it, in all seriousness, then it's like, whoa, this is way out of hand.
But it was so bifurcated, because the first half of it is an argument in favor of getting out of your own headspace as a writer, and then this,
which is what writers do.
Yeah, and yeah, and
even if you are writing about your own culture or whatever you're writing about, you're writing about aliens, doesn't matter, you are somewhere else.
And then the second half was this like sarcastic, you know, again, yeah, that something that was supposed to be edgy, the thing like saying, you know what, we should even go so far as having a prize. If he had kept up the string and like and said, you know what, along with, as we've done in this issue, bringing up Aboriginal writers to talk from their point of view about their own culture, it does sort of behoove us to, we who are white and are from sort of the invading culture, to sort of mm-hmm. Reach out and better understand these other cultures too. And one can have an understanding of the culture without, you know, taking it over. I think there also may be a misunderstanding of the word appropriation. Appropriation is something like, you know, when in the middle of the 90s, when, you know, Madonna went, you know, full
yes.
Hindi with all the henna tattoos and everything. That's yeah. appropriation, because there's this near drop of Indian blood in Madonna. And it was for no purpose other than this is cool. That's appropriation.
And then adopting children from India was a requirement for a while among the stars, right?
Right. Or Africa.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, all that, I mean, that's, you know, appropriation. And when you are from those cultures that are appropriated and sort of turned into this mass appeal thing, you might understand why the word is so loaded and why so many people might take offense. But I think that's where the tenure was. And then you have somebody like Andrew Coyne, who's a typically smart guy, and go, well, I guess we're going to have to agree to disagree.
Hmm.
No, appropriation is bad.
Yep.
And you would see that if you were from one of these cultures that were frequently being appropriated or have trouble accessing, you know, the mainstream media.
From the two white guys at Open Sources to you. We try, though, folks. If you listen to our show and listen to the archives, we really do try. I mean, you know, somebody is probably listening to this saying, oh, you guys are ones to talk because you're this, this, and this. And that's completely fine. But
yeah.
We really, honestly, from our hearts, do try here. And we will never, ever appropriate your culture.
Well, we will try not to. I mean, I think we're a little bit better self-aware than somebody like Steve Laudrinatage.
I
butchered that name. Yeah.
The editor from the National.
Laudrinatage. There we go.
What culture is he from? Who knows?
But he literally wrote an article for JSource like 4 years ago with rules for journalists on Twitter. And one of the rules was you're one tweet away from being fired.
Ooh, there
and
you go.
And so, you know.
Had a premonition
there. There's cultural appropriation. There's not being even self-aware of your own culture, even if you're the one making the rules for it.
With your unpronounceable name. Yes. We better let it go before it goes into the...
This was Scotty's idea, not mine.
Today we're going to talk about Adam Donaldson and his column
yes.
in Guelph Today, which was excellent, by the way, and I'm saying that independently. I do know Adam, obviously, but...
thank you.
So tell us about your column, Adam. It was fantastic.
Well, it was. You can read it on GuelphToday.com. You can just follow the link from. You can scroll down and find the Market Squared. But it was basically about how there's another flip side of Guelph that we never see and rarely talk about, and that is that, you know, there are a lot of people struggling out there. A lot of poor people, and the news doesn't really reach them, or the people who are affected by drugs, or the people, you know, who were on campus here and took their own lives throughout last year, which we kind of know the cold hard facts of that. We know when someone's arrested for drug possession, it's in the daily police blotter. We know when someone takes their own life on campus, you know, it's a notice on the university website, but we never get down to the reasons why. And I guess the thesis of that was like, there's an invisible world that sort of lives very parallel to ours, but either because of either willful ignorance or our own, again, biases, we don't really see it. And it seemed to touch a nerve. And I was very surprised that, I mean, I shouldn't have been surprised, but it definitely made the rounds. And I was quite humbled by a lot of people who said that it affected them and that it captured what they were feeling and what they were seeing. So
for sure.
I was
as many
humbled.
Shares as the Taco Bell story, but still, it was good though. It was making the rounds. I think beyond the shares themselves, it was definitely making the rounds of social media.
But you know,
media.
that's a point I wanted to make, and I didn't make that in the column.
I was alluding to it. Yeah, yeah.
And we were joking about this.
Yes,
at the
it
time.
Happened. It came up before. Yeah.
But it's like 1,300 shares on this Taco Bell story about two Taco Bells coming to Guelph. And then I remembered this story that Rob O'Flanagan did for the Guelph Today, where he went out to the homeless camp.
Yes.
And it was on university property.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had campus
away.
Police there, you had Guelph police services there, and you had bylaw there all sort of shooing these people.
Mm-hmm.
That story got, I wrote it down.
Three.
It wasn't quite that bad.
No.
But it was 247 shares.
Yes. And I mean, we really shouldn't base the complete traction of a story on how many shares something gets. But it's indicative of who's reading it and who's...
Exactly.
It's an indicator. And some of the comments, too, which are, you know, decent and well-meaning, and others are just like, what, you know, the usual, right? Mm. But you do, I mean, you touched on a fantastic point. You called it the cracks in the facade. We have this image or idea or projection of Guelph, and we like to think that other people like Guelph. I'm thinking in particular of, well, when we were at Nikki Ashton, she commented on about mm-hmm. the something being in the water or something like that, and mm-hmm. Nathan Cullen, something in the air. I know I'm just mentioning NDP people, but those are two that I think off the top of my head that have actually commented on Guelph. Nathan Cullen specifically talked about the civic activism here.
Right.
Which leads into our next story, actually, coincidentally, but I wasn't thinking about that when I was trying to make the point. And then you have the other things, too, like the movies in town, and you know, it's a popular place for the stars to come, and Murdoch Mysteries coming. Yet I was thinking when I was thinking about this story in my neighborhood was when James Franco was filming, and the guy who was on crystal meth and the moped drove right through the film shoot. I mean, there's the two worlds colliding right there. And everybody thinks it's funny. It's kind of a jokey thing. It's like, ah, oh, typical Guelph, typical Ward. You know, it's the kind of thing that doesn't really affect other parts of town, like, say, the South End. And I think we talked about this at length on the other show, Beyond the Bow Box and whatnot, about mm-hmm. the whole, let's call it the divide in Guelph. Those of us that live in, say, the downtown area or frequent the downtown core see a lot more, I think, than people in the periphery, even from, let's call it from Stone Road on, where if your entire existence is just, you know, Stone Road Mall and then wherever you work, which probably isn't in Guelph, you might not see a lot of this. And I think the collision is going to come with the amount, and it is sort of changing because you can see it now. With the condo builds that have been going on in town and how you have sort of that, I wouldn't say it's straight out of Dickens, but you got the condos and then the shadow of the condos, you got, I won't name his name, but the fella in the Wellingtons that walks around with no pants on, in full view of that. So you really see the disconnect there where you've got this, well, I wouldn't call it beautiful, but this brand new pristine building mm-hmm. that's supposed to represent everything that's great about progress and a new population and the tax base is going to increase and it's going to pay for this and this and this. And then directly and quite literally across the tracks, you have this sort of other world. As you say, the
upside down.
Upside down. I was going to say the left behind. I was like, that's the story I haven't written yet. The upside down. And I have watched Stranger Things. It's a fantastic show. But yeah, you're right.
And it's also very Metropolis, the Fritz Lang movie.
Yes.
Where all the rich people live in the towers and then all the working class and covered
so it hasn't really,
work below.
It hasn't really changed in 100 years, has it?
No. And it's just something that sort of struck, all these things sort of coalesce at once. What was interesting was that I was working on this last Wednesday and I wasn't sure what I was going to write about, and this kind of all coalesced into one thing. So mm-hmm. let that be a lesson that, you know, sometimes good writing isn't necessarily, you know, super planned out in advance. You can write well on the fly. But one of the things that struck me was definitely the out of poverty society on 40 Baker mm-hmm. and how that is that sort of closed like super quietly back in April. It just sort of like flitted away. I'm not even 100% sure of the story there either, because they lost two big tenants in the building.
As far as I understand it, it's the owner has other plans.
Right.
Now, whether that's a renovation, whether it's a flattening for a condo, because there's one going next door, that empty lot that's been there forever. You worked at
yes.
Thomas, and that was...
Yes.
Sometimes you could park there, and then they put a fence up, and then you couldn't
yes.
park there. I believe that's slated for a condo. And
yes.
then as to whether 40 Baker, and this is just speculative on my part, because real estate is all about speculation, as to whether they're going to make the building over or just toast it completely and...
Well, they can't... I'm not sure they can toast it completely, because it's right there against the old sewing factory.
Yeah, but I mean, anything's possible, as we know, in terms of developers putting in proposals, right?
Yeah,
they tend to always get what they
but
want.
But I don't think it's
in my
that
opinion.
Easy. But yeah,
it's fairly easy, I think. I don't
well,
think
we'll
it's,
see.
We're, getting, we're a completely different topic, which I love.
But
yeah, the pipes go in before the condo's even approved. Easy, right? Because that's what happened. Anyway, I'm completely off topic.
No,
tell
no,
us
you're
more
right.
About,
it's
it all sort of blends into itself.
But it, the point is, it just sort of flitted away, and now
yes.
there's actually a sort of mobile 40 Baker,
which is fantastic. I mean, I wish things were better, but it is great that it still lives on and some
right.
capacity because it's so necessary. It really is. I mean, they seem to be they were overwhelmed at 40 Baker.
Yeah.
The mobile version, which still seems to go to 40 Baker, is also really, really busy by the looks of it. And and so you notice it too, because do you frequent the downtown branch of the library as well, on off? Mm-hmm. Probably, yeah, because you're down there all the time. Me too. It seems that the library has become sort of the new 40 Baker, from what I've noticed. I mean, there's always people in there using the computers and whatever, and that's great. That's mm-hmm. what it's for.
Yeah.
But there's also, I guess there's just been the shift down the street. It's like, well, nothing's open. We're just going to go to the library. So it sort of, amplifies the point that space is really needed. And then when you look downtown, there is lots of empty space.
Yes.
40 Baker's got, there's lots of empty shops. And you think somebody who owns that property would have it in them to say, well, you can use this for a while. It's been sitting empty for years, but.
Well, look at that strip behind the Bank of Montreal.
Yeah.
Those are all, like, right next to the post office. Those are all empty shops.
Yeah. The square was in there for a while, the little, and it's just empty.
Yeah, and it's, there's so much.
You can't argue that there isn't space for people to go.
Right.
Gordon Taylor Music Strip as well. That's all empty.
That's a big empty as
because
well.
Because I had some company in from BC, and they had lived here at one point. They said, let's go downtown, look at the downtown. And a couple people still there. Dino's still there. Ray's still there, right?
Yeah.
But they marveled at the fact that how much was just sort of empty. Considering mm-hmm. how, we like to strengthen the downtown. There's a shop downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know somebody else in town that can't go because of accessibility issues, right? So mm-hmm. We love the downtown, of course. But at the same time, it's like there's lots of room for improvement. What's improvement? More coffee or?
Well, I do sometimes wonder to myself, how many more coffee shops and microbreweries can we handle? But which is fine. But yeah, the question is, what is there for people who are not part of that culture, or not part of like the startup culture and the hyper aware online mm-hmm. hashtag Guelph proud culture, because those people are very difficult to reach. And the flip side of it is we don't really take any opportunity to invite those people to become a part of our society, because I think there's an element of guilt there that they are not already part of that society. So we don't like to look at the things that where we have failed, and we have certainly failed these people that there's nowhere for them to go, nowhere to congregate, nowhere that for them to feel part of a community, which is what I think 40 Baker was. And there are a lot of people who would drive down for Baker Street and talk about and I mentioned this in the article, talking about those people in quote marks
mm-hmm.
without ever really engaging with them. They think they're a problem, they think they're a menace, and I can't really that has never been my experience.
Me neither.
I was with Edvidia, which was in 40 Baker Street for 7 or 8 years. And I worked along Baker Street, just walked along Baker Street, never had a problem with anyone who's hanging out in front of the Baker Street. They're just, all people going about their business, going about their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people right now who are kind of glad that 40 Baker Street is out of business, because that means they don't have to see big groups. This would be a great day for a lot of them to be hanging out up front, enjoying the sunshine. But now they don't really have to deal with that driving down Baker Street.
And if I got it right, some of the talk was that there was going to be a space made in 10 Carden. I keep wanting to call it Ackers.
I think
Ackers
Chalmers is moving into 10 Carden.
Chalmers is moving, but
or the new 10C, as they're calling it.
But not Baker per se. I guess that's a separate.
No, the OOPS is not moving in.
The clientele is moving will in. Probably be the same though now.
More than likely.
Right. Yeah. So, landlords out there, if you're listening, if you've got some spare capacity that you want to cough up for good cause.
Yes. Don't call us.
No, don't call us.
But definitely, it's something worth
thinking
about.
Don't build another condo either. I think we've got enough. But anyway.
Yeah. So, we're going to take a break now and get situated with our guests, and then we will be right back to talk about democracy and democracy Guelph. You're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
What's up? This is Teaspoon from Delhi to Dublin, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
drown my fear till you all just disappear. Black old sun, won't you
of y'all out there probably know that song. That was a cover of Black Hole Sun by a band called the Stella Starlight Trio from their album The Best So Far. What do you say,
2014?
And that was in honor of Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, passed away at 52 years young, yes. Which seems to be a rock and roll age, 28, 52, and then...
Well, he doubled the 27 rule, which was another rock
52.
Yeah.
So...
We have a couple of ranging rockers with us today. So I want to welcome the chair of Democracy Guelph, Anne Gajerski-Colley, and Steve Dick. Are you a member at large, or do you have an official title?
I think I'm in charge of mobilization.
Excellent.
Yeah.
We'll go with that. So if you don't know Democracy Guelph, they are a local group that formed in order to keep pushing the local, well, more than the local, but they're hoping to continue to keep electoral reform on the radar for the country, and are even advocating for a local solution, local proportional representation. We have talked about all this on the show before, so I will assume our listeners don't need a catch up to LPR. So let's just get into sort of where we are now. I was looking back at my own coverage of it. This was back in March. You kind of had the big rollout at the E-Bar with Lloyd Longfield there, Full House. And then you guys were going out to start the promotion process to get the petitions going. So where are you guys now? How many names have you assembled? How's it going?
Well, we're right around 3,000 signatures on our petition. And I would say probably the most exciting part of that process has been like the collaboration between diverse groups in Guelph to get behind this. Conversations with Council of Canadians and Lead Now and Fair Vote were you know just a couple of the organizations that are really there. This is a topic that's they're passionate about besides political parties.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just point out, like I was a Green Party candidate and Anne was a New Democratic candidate, so it's so energizing and enlivening to have that kind of collaboration and consensus building on behalf of Canada.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, just to throw something out there, there was the BC election last week. Yeah,
woo-hoo.
Three Greens elected. But there's a lot of talk now about how Greens can leverage what happened in the BC election. Can they push for PR there?
Mike Schreiner and I recently had a conversation about that. So he's in touch with the leader there.
Right.
And that is going to be on the agenda for sure, because, I mean, the other thing is that if we had a provincial model for proportional representation, that could go a long way in bringing this to the country. And that, as you know, is how we got Medicare in this country, was through Tommy Douglas initiating that in Saskatchewan. So, that might be a really exciting opening for the PR option.
Mm-hmm. I think that's probably going to be a couple of years off, but I know you guys are sort of intent on keeping Justin Trudeau to his word. So, I mean, we've had, you know, I want to set something straight too, and perhaps it doesn't need to be set straight, but just in case, Lloyd Longfield is on your side. You know, he is sort of being, I guess, maybe being the arbiter towards, you know, the people he's working with in Ottawa and the people he's representing here in Guelph, that there is sympathy from Lloyd on that front.
I think I'll say again, and I think I've said this numerous times, Lloyd is in a challenging situation.
Right.
His leader has said, we're not doing electoral reform. You know, it was my promise to break, and I'm breaking it. So what do you do when your boss says that?
Yeah.
Right? I do think that Lloyd, his other words were, at our the Fair Vote Electoral Reform Town Hall, is there's cracks in the foundation of our democracy. Mm-hmm. I think Lloyd is at heart a consensus builder, and I think he's suffering greatly with the toxic, divisive, nasty, adversarial, winner-take-all environment that he's having to work under. I think he is doing some soul-searching. We have been talking to him about Nathan Cullen's very important work, asking the House of Commons to receive the electoral reform report. Mm-hmm. It was a consultation across Canada. Many, many thousands of Canadians provided their input. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be very disrespectful for the House of Commons to reject that report or to vote no to it. Mm-hmm. Right now, Lloyd has expressed concerns that the report or recommendation includes a referendum.
Right.
And a referendum is something that Lloyd it struggles with.
Right.
So, there's my thoughts. Anne, do you want to jump in and say something about it?
Yeah, I think that you can't have a fair referendum between two systems when one is experienced and one isn't.
Sure.
So having a referendum, if one were to lay out a PR system and then you voted on it, so the electorate would actually be able to make an informed decision about what system of governance they want, if people want to retain the first past the post, or if they want to move and make permanent a PR system in this country. But you, to speak about making having a referendum before anyone has even tried it on doesn't make sense. So
yeah.
I wonder whether the referendum issue may very well just be a distraction and a red herring. And we also know across the country where there have been referendums, they've been set up to fail, right? So you throw the dog a bone and then hope the dog goes away. So I would support a referendum for Canadians if they had a chance to try it out first, and then they could make an truly informed decision about what kind of electoral system Canadians actually want.
And you make a good point too, that when we're talking about referendum, first past the post versus PR, it does help to have that very specific idea in mind. And I think that's sort of where we've been faltering for those who want the electoral reform to go through and want PR, is that there hasn't been a model, which is why I find the LPR so persuasive. It's like, here's a specific model that you can explain to people. This is what it could look like, versus a more just saying, like, we could have proportional representation, which, as you guys know, is sort of very nebulous because there are numerous versions of PR.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't be like, I do wonder too about the referendum issue, if that's like sort of a way to sort of couch not doing something as a democracy or as a pro-democratic move. But I do wonder, isn't there a bit of give and take here? The Conservatives are kind of the ones who are looking to get a referendum. We know what we want. We want to move to a more egalitarian democratic system. And if doing this with a bit less sort of antagonism from the other side is to do a referendum, I mean, is it not the responsibility to meet it halfway, do you think?
Well, I kind of, for me, it is important to have a government that's responsive to voters, and, mm-hmm. and how we vote is a really important question. So I could say, sure, let's try a proportional system, or we could have a referendum between proportional systems, and so people get to choose which of the proportional systems they want to go forward with. It does require some leadership, it
right.
does require some commitment to having every vote count, which is something that Mr. Trudeau spoke to, and I think Lloyd does. He talks about being a collaborator and a consensus builder. That's what you know, during the election, his election, he intended to be, you know, that person.
Right.
I would say that I there's been a lot more effort put into legalizing marijuana, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of leadership, than there has been to actually having really taking our voting system and moving it forward. There hasn't been the leadership, and I'm just gonna, like, the BC election is a phenomenal example. Right now, we're on tender hooks mm-hmm. based on how 9 people voted.
Yeah,
and that will decide the complete makeup of this next government in BC, which is just crazy. This is an out of control, flip flopping system. It's not. It doesn't actually respond in a natural way to, you know, a conversation about what you know, a consensus of people mm-hmm. want. So that in itself would be a reason why. And yeah, to have the Greens be all of a sudden in this make or break situation, that doesn't make any sense either. What you want to have is you know, consensus building discussions about good policy, mm-hmm. not a winner take all situation where, you know, you get 4 years of one policy and then it flips and you get another 4 years of an opposite policy. Very expensive and bad for business, bad for, you know, voters or politicians trying to buy elections by another majority.
We have in our country, really, and Great Britain, of course, as well, a system of that are really elected for your dictatorships if you get a majority government. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of concerns right now in the U.S. around Trump's presidency in that
Who's
he...
Who's Trump?
Donald who?
I had to.
It's like every week.
He gives me such joy of life, let me tell you. He has engaged progressives in a way that we haven't seen in a very, very long time. And so a lot of people are concerned about his presidential executive orders. But in fact, they have such a system of checks and balances in the U.S. that it makes it, even with a Republican Senate, a Republican House, and a Republican president, you know, he couldn't get through his healthcare aspirations. Right. In Canada, if you get a majority government, you literally have carte blanche. You can do whatever you like for 4 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a very old and devolved system. We really need to be moving with the times. In 1867, 150 years ago, only 10% of the Canadian population was eligible to vote. Mm-hmm. You know, and they were not just men, but men with property. And so over time, we've added to that system. And I think now it's time to get rid of first past the post and have a more democratic system where people actually feel their vote does count, and that our parliament actually more greatly reflects, you know, the values, the aspirations of Canadians. The system we have now just doesn't do that. And it's too vulnerable to shenanigans, as we've seen in that. We've seen here in Guelph, we were the mm-hmm. epicenter of the greatest electoral crime in Canadian history. And so I think PR could go a long way to help ameliorate that. And it would also change the face of what Parliament would look like. You'd see a lot more women in Parliament, and we're half the population. So we know that from the experiences in other countries. So I think Canadians are modern people. They want to see their institutions evolve in a way that's more consistent with a modern country.
So what's going on with Democracy Guelph right now in terms of, I know there is that vote coming up in the House on the report. Mm-hmm. I know that's a pretty big benchmark because I don't know. I mean, that certainly won't end it for you guys. I understand that. But from a parliamentary priority perspective, that would, whether it would pass or fail, would probably be a pretty big demarcation point for how this issue is going to be considered going forward. In the rest of the current mandate, because if it passes, that means it's something still a fly in Trudeau's ointment. But if it fails, he can say, well, Parliament didn't accept it and we have to carry on with other affairs of state. So what are you guys looking at right now in terms of what you're doing and promoting ER?
We're going to continue with our game plan. We're going to continue with our with the local PR model that we want to promote, and we have substantive support from Jean-Pierre Kingsley, for instance, who's the one of the world's leading authorities on electoral reform, as well as others. Academics are getting on board, and they see the practicality of this model because it brings in proportionality without having to change riding boundaries. For instance, it's not too. It's a very good first step towards the movement of proportionality, and it also has within it its structure the capacity to make it even more proportional than it is in its first stages. So yeah, we would continue to put that forward because it reflects Canadian electoral values. It reflects what Canadians said to the parliamentary committee, and that is a good place to go.
You mentioned you have 3,000 signatures. Mm. Are you feeling like maybe you're tapping out? You're maybe seeing some of the same faces around when you're canvassing, or is there
it's actually really, really exciting. One of the things that's really fun. The farmers market is one place that mm-hmm. We have a lot of conversations, and very thoughtful people come by and say, "Oh, you know what? I can't sign that up, but do you have something I can look at?" And so they'll take one of our flyers and they'll go to the Democracy Guelph website. And they'll say, okay, yeah. Then the next week, they'll come back and say, oh, yeah, you guys are here. Thanks for being there. And I've signed it online. Mm-hmm. We'll say, well, you know, it, like what Lloyd can present to Parliament is the paper mm-hmm. signature. And so that's the 3,000 paper signatures that we register. By no means do we feel like we're tapped out. One of the things that's, again, from my perspective, most exciting is the process of consensus building and working across different organizations. This last weekend, we were very gifted. We had Lynn Grist, who's involved with the Council of Canadians here mm-hmm. in Guelph, and she's a gifted facilitator. We brought together, I guess, really some engaged, passionate people from Democracy Guelph and Ann Papert, who was Guelph's CFO until recently. So Anne and David is also on the board for Democracy Guelph, had written up a strategic plan, mm-hmm. and they presented this in a workshop looking at our strategy, how to move forward. And Lynn Grist facilitated this 3-hour event on a Saturday, you know, spring Saturday. It was I would say quite heated. I was amazed at how passionate the views were in the room, how much energy there were, and how things actually came together quite well after hearing each other. So it's in terms of the different schedules, what's going on. We've got May 30th, we think, is Nathan Cullen's motion is going to be brought into the House. And that's taking up a lot of bandwidth. You know, like mm-hmm. Fair Vote Canada is working on that. Also Council Canadians, you know, they're working on that. Lead Now, you know, so there's a lot of bandwidth.
It's a week from Tuesday.
Yeah, a lot of bandwidth taken up there. We're looking forward to engaging these organizations in a national way. Kind of after that, you know, like, so that'll happen. But then the experience of working together on this very important experience, it's around democracy and consensus building. And in some ways, like, the heavy lifting is agreeing on a specific system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these organizations actually are about. They don't really care about voting systems.
Mm-hmm.
What they really want is they want consensus-based democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a gift that I've experienced here in Guelph, and I think it's going to go across the country.
You two have both been working on this issue for a long time. So what has made this experience working on Democracy Guelph different for you, and maybe what have you learned about, again, that consensus building and working on this issue that now that you perhaps you hadn't before?
Well, I've been in the NDP since I was, since I was a youngster, actually. I mean, I grew up in Manitoba. I grew up under an NDP government. So and as you probably know, we have mixed member proportional is our policy. So, mm-hmm. And when you're working within parties on electoral reform, which has been primarily the New Democrats and the Greens, you're used to working with people, who you're working on a lot of stuff with. For me coming, when I got, it was Mike Schreiner who came up to me. I was at the Muslim Society dinner in January, and Mike came up to me and said, "And you know, we need to work together on all this electoral reform stuff." And I said, "Okay, sure, let's talk." And then what happened was the Prime Minister just broke his promise shortly thereafter, yeah. And that really mobilized the community here in Guelph. And we were very intentional that we needed to work across party lines, that we needed to come together and put aside whatever differences that we have. To work for this, because this is very important. And one of the things that I have said, I've experienced it in working across parties, because I'm not used to doing that, is if we want to challenge, and I speak as a New Democrat, if we are behind and if the Greens are behind a proportional representation, that actually necessitates putting aside what you don't share in common,
right,
to work on what you do share in common. And if you cannot do that before you have PR, then you have no business having this as a policy.
Right.
So this is rehearsing and practiced. And it's been a really joyful, delightful experience. And I've really, really loved working and collaborating with other people and learning, that, hey, like, other people think really differently than I do, and that's okay, because we're all working towards something else. And if we can do it locally here, if Greens and Liberals and Conservatives and New Democrats and others can work together on this, then we can do it nationally for sure. And that's a great thing. That's a wonderful thing.
Steve, I hope Anne's answer was good enough for you, because unfortunately we are out of time. But if people want to engage with Democracy Guelph, how could they do that?
Well, there's allvotescount.ca is the URL for our website. Phone number, boy, I should memorize that now. But there's a phone number for us. Online is the best. You could call my cell phone, 519-994-4749, and I can get you connected too.
Well, thanks so much, Angusterski colleague Steve Dick. Thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the fight. Keep on keeping on.
Thanks, Adam.
And thanks for having us.
Yeah. You're very welcome. Unfortunately, like I said, that is a wrap for us for this week. Next week on the show, we will have Ward 3 Councillor Phil Ault here. So stay tuned for that. You can stay connected to us at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, you can get the podcast on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at the Spanner Book, but not recently. But maybe. We'll see.
Can I also mention we're on Facebook, Democracy Guelph.
All right.
There you go.
So lots to look up on Facebook this holiday weekend. In the meantime, you can stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Thursday at 5.